And we're back. Jay Monchi, EA Radio. We are on the fly. We'll continue our show.
I'm here with Andrew King. Andrew King flew the Pitcairn Autogyro up to EA Air Venture 2009. Andrew, what an adventure.
Yeah, well, I think that's a little bit of an understatement, but yeah, I've had some pretty good adventures, but that one certainly ranks right up there with the rest of them. Cruising across country in a Pitcairn Autogyro is a pretty unique experience.
So we talked to Jack Tiffany earlier and Nick, and they had the adventure of acquiring the airplane, getting it restored, getting it ready to fly. How did you come on board?
Well, it was here at Oshkosh one year when they had Jack had helped restore the Waco INF that belongs to Ted Teach that was here parked in front of the Red Barn a couple of years ago, probably 3 or 4 years ago maybe now, and happened to be standing there talking with him. And he said, hey, if you want to be the pilot for the autogyro, you know, the offer is there. So, you know, I thought for 3/10 of a second about it and said, yeah, I'll do that. Then it was a matter of getting legal, getting the rating. It's a rotorcraft gyroplane rating. And figuring out how to fly the autogyro, which is a basically completely different proposition.
Yeah, that's no light chore. So now you say, yes, sure, I'll do it. And then it's like, oh, but wait a minute.
Well, you know, I live in Virginia, and the autogyro is in Dayton, and it's about an eight-hour drive to get out there. And Kate, Jack's wife, said to me one time, she said, oh, we're lucky we found you. I don't know anybody else would drive 8 hours to fly this thing. And I said, boy, Kate, I can name about 20 people in the next 30 seconds that would gladly drive 8 hours to do it. So, you know, it was a tremendous privilege to have the offer. And so I called around the country. There's actually not that many gyroplane instructors, and I discovered that none of them would let you solo because they can't get insurance for soloing their airplanes. Basically, you have to have your own gyroplane pretty much. It may be different now, but at that point, it was very hard to find somebody that would solo you in a gyroplane. And I talked to a guy named Dauphin Fritz down in Alabama, down in Bruton, Alabama, southern Alabama near Pensacola. And I don't know, maybe I sounded trustworthy on the phone or something, but he said, well, I'll solo you. And so I hopped in my car and drove down to Alabama and flew with Dauphin for about a week and a half, put in about 28 or 30 hours or so, and indeed soloed and did a little bit of solo cross-country work and that kind of thing. And then, there aren't very many examiners for gyroplanes in the country. And the FAA, there's an examiner from Connecticut, and they flew her down to Alabama, but they had to have a month's notice, so I had to go home for a month, then come back, fly a little bit to get current again, and then take my check ride, which fortunately went fine and passed the check ride and got the rating. And then, as I say, it's kind of a different proposition is then how to fly the autogyro, because it's really a very different airplane from any of the modern gyrocopters.
So what type of aircraft did you fly for the rating?
I flew an RAF 2000. It's a two-seat side-by-side, tilting rotor, modern gyrocopter type. Experimental. They have a waiver so they can do instruction in the experimentals, because there aren't any, I don't believe there are any certificated autogyros available for instruction at this point. There was only a few made in the last 40 years, and as I say, I don't believe there's a few flying, but I don't think anybody offers dual instruction in them. So most of the instruction you get is in an experimental gyroplane. And I had been told by Steve Pitcairn, by Steve Pitcairn, that's the end of the question, that it would be nothing like the autogyro would be nothing like a gyrocopter, and indeed it's 99% different. It's just the feel of auto rotation is the same, and there are a few principles, the vertical descents and things like that, that are the same, but you know, not having the tilt rotor makes it a very different flying airplane.
Now Steve Pitcairn, of course, has passed away. So did you talk to him before he passed away with some semblance of hope that you would one day fly an autogyro?
Well, I knew Steve since I was a teenager, actually, because I grew up at Rhinebeck, and Steve used to come up. And I mean, I didn't know him well, but he knew who I was, and I knew Steve a little bit. And so when the chance came up to fly the Pitcairn, obviously he was one of the people I talked to. And, you know, he had a few pointers, but he kind of said, no, just don't worry about it. You know, he kind of told me that I was the right guy for the job from my experience flying at Rhinebeck and flying a variety of vintage airplanes. And he was encouraging, you know, he said it, he didn't think it would be much of a problem and not to worry about it too much. Now, I also talked to Johnny Miller, who, of course, recently died. I think he was 103 when he died, and I talked to him when he was 101. And his memory, he couldn't really remember yesterday too well, but he could remember 1922 like it was yesterday. And he had some good pointers and told me some things. For instance, if you land in over a 10-mile-an-hour wind, you have to turn the tail so that it faces the wind, so that the wind is on top of the rotors to prevent them from flapping and things like that. So Johnny was pretty helpful also. And in fact, Johnny and Steve both died, I think, within about 6 months before we flew the Autogyro, which was very disappointing for us because both of them, we wanted to see the Autogyro fly.
Well, and so that takes us to a point. So they were in the restoration. At what point did Jack Tiffany call you and say, "Hey, Andrew, we're going to be done with this in 6 months"? Or at what point did you start preparing?
Well, the airplane was actually done, I think maybe close to 3 years ago. It was actually done, ready to put gas in and fly, but there was paperwork struggles that they had to go through. It has a different dash number engine on it. It's almost the same. It's still 160 horsepower, five-cylinder Kenner, but it was a different dash number. The original airplanes used a metal propeller, and it turned out they found with the experience that the metal propeller and the five-cylinder Kenner was a bad combination, and they were breaking crankshafts. But there were so few autogyros with that combination on them and so few airplanes with that combination of engine and propeller, there was never an AD. There was never any change in the type certificate data sheets. And so the type certificate data sheet still said the R5 Kenner with the metal propeller. And, of course, that wasn't safe. We had to have a wooden propeller and an R55. It's basically a Myers OTW combination, same engine as a PT-22 and a Myers OTW prop. But the field approval took a lot of time and effort to get through, and we finally came upon a guy in the Chicago certification office named Scott Foreman, who helped us out a lot navigating the paperwork trails of getting the field approval. So it took a while to get the field approval after the airplane was really ready to go. But one time on the way back from Oshkosh, I stopped in New Carlisle, and we ran the thing up, and I spun the rotors up for the first time. And I'll tell you, that was... just doing that was a unique experience. The rotors all have universal hinges at the bases of the rotors, so they can flap up and down and lead and lag. And when you start spinning it up, after it gets to about 15 or 20 RPM, the rotors are kind of all off-centered, and the whole airplane starts to shake. And if they hadn't warned me about it beforehand, it would have been frightening, probably. And even as it was, you kind of looked at the people standing around watching, thinking, run, run, you know. But it's a little bit of ground resonance, and once you get up to about 60 RPM, it starts to go away. The blades kind of find their own centers, and then it goes away, and it's smooth. But that's one of the interesting things about flying it, is the ground resonance when you're spinning up the rotor.
So... you did that, but that you weren't ready to fly. This was just kind of a test run, just to kind of try it out, just to see how it felt. And then the paperwork came through, and then what?
Well, it was, I think it was June of 08 that finally everything really was ready. It had the airworthiness certificate, registration, all the paperwork was done. And I went out to New Carlisle. We waited for a day that we thought the wind was going to be pretty calm, and indeed the wind was pretty calm. Pulled the airplane out. Actually, I think maybe it was the month before, we got the airplane out, and I wanted to do some taxi testing with it. And so we fired it up, and I wanted to see how it steered. It's got a full swivel tailwheel. I want to see how the brakes work. They're old-fashioned cable-operated brakes. And so I got it out on the runway and made a few slow runs up and down the runway, just feeling out a little bit, and turned into the wind. The wind, unfortunately, had started to pick up a little bit. And I turned into the wind and opened the throttle a little bit to make another run, and the blades weren't spinning. We had debated locking the blades or having them spin, and we thought, well, the books say that if they're spinning, they're more stable. Well, we were only half right. If they're spinning more than 65 RPM, they're stable, but less than that, they're actually not stable, and it's better to lock them off. And so we had them spinning about 20, and we had a blade flap where the blade going into the wind flew up in front, and then it slammed down in the back, and a couple of the blades actually hit the top of the vertical fin. And so that gave us some repairs to do. We got the repairs done a couple of months or a month later, and I went back out there and did the first four test flights.
And that would have been right before AirVenture last year, huh?
Yeah, it was a little bit. It was about a month before. I think it was in June. I think the first little incident we had might have been in May, and then in June it was fixed and ready to try again. And I went out, and we got a calm day. We got out there early in the morning, fired it up, got out on the runway, got the rotors spinning up. Our rotor tack, as it turned out, was a little bit off. It was indicating 100. We were only getting about 80, which is still okay. Anything above 65 is good. But got out on the end of the runway and released the rotor clutch and opened up the throttle. And, you know, anytime you test fly an airplane, there's a little bit of a feeling of, you know, what's going to happen now. And that was about five times as much on the first flight of the autogyro because there's so much happening at that point and all that stuff flapping around over your head. And it's a really different experience. And I opened the throttle and got going down the runway. And now the rotor blades are supposed to pick up speed until they get flying speed. And then you go airborne. And in a lot of the old movies that you watch, boy, the autogyros get off the ground pretty quick. And this one seemed to take a longer ground roll than I thought it was going to take. And, you know, I was a little worried. I thought about aborting, but it finally did break ground, and it seemed to be have a positive climb rate, seemed to be controllable. All the controls were working fine, so I kept on going and got it up to pattern altitude and flew around for a while. And it actually flew surprisingly well at normal cruise speeds. So, you know, started to enjoy myself a little bit and came around and made probably one of the best landings that I've made on the first landing, which, of course, is probably a common thing on test flights, too, because you're concentrating so hard. But so we took a look at everything and made sure everything was staying tight and made two more flights that day. And then the next morning, we wanted to make a fourth flight. And the autogyro, the Pitcairns, most of them have a belly tank that's the main tank, and then they have a header tank that's mounted high in front of the front cockpit. And there's a fuel pump, and all it does is pump fuel from the belly tank to the header tank, and then it gravity feeds to the engine, and whatever overflow there is just drains back to the main tank. And you have a fuel pressure gauge that's only running, I think we only had it at about a pound and a half of pressure at that point. And the theory is that when it goes to zero, then you know your belly tank is dry or your engine-driven pump has failed, and you've got a wobble pump backup. Well, before I took off, it went to zero, and we knew we had fuel in the belly tank, so we thought the engine-driven pump had failed, which it had, but the header tank, we thought, had an hour's worth of fuel in it. Well, as it turned out, we were burning more fuel, we had a higher fuel consumption than we expected, and we hadn't flown it enough to really measure it at that point. We'd only been making like 20-minute flights. And the header tank actually was a little smaller than we thought. And in any event, so we thought, well, we have an hour's worth of fuel. That's plenty of time to make a half-hour flight. Well, I flew around for half an hour, and I was flying around, fortunately, about 1,500 feet above the airport, well, probably within half a mile of the airport. And I was thinking, you know, it comes down pretty steep and has a lot of drag, and I've been carrying a little power on landings, and I thought, geez, I haven't landed at really power off yet. I'd hate to have to make a dead stick landing in it. And about 2 minutes later, the prop stopped. So there I was. And again, fortunately, pretty close to the airport and pretty high. And I remembered some of the stuff. This was one of the things that I did learn during my gyrocopter training is that, of course, the autogyro won't stall. It just does a vertical descent if you pull the stick back. And Johnny Miller had warned against stretching the glide that it would do that. But I learned from Doof and Fritz down in Alabama that you could use it to your advantage. And I came in very high off the end of the runway, pulled it into a vertical descent, went straight down, you know, under the windmilling rotors until I got to the point where I thought I should be, nosed over and put it right down on the runway where I'd been putting it down before. So carried off the successful forced landing and a sigh of relief. And then we realized that the tank didn't have as much gas in it. There's a lot of confusion between the PCA-2 like Miss Champion information and the PA-18, and there's not much information on the PA-18. And sometimes the two get mixed together, and so that was one of the reasons I think we thought we had more fuel in the header tank than we did. But so we learned that, and we, you know, the lessons, we learned a lot of lessons. It was a pretty steep learning curve in the beginning, but on all of the flights the airplane wasn't climbing very well, and we talked to a bunch of people, and as I say, the information is so scarce to decide what to do. And Steve had always said that 120 rpm was the rpm to shoot for on the autogyro, and we were getting a little bit faster than that. So we thought that adding a little bit of pitch would slow it down a little bit, and maybe that would help climb it. So we tried that, and unfortunately we got too much in it. And the next takeoff, we got over-coning of the blades and flexed them a little bit and kinked the trail and edges a little bit. It didn't really hurt him very bad, but Jack is kind of a perfectionist, and he couldn't stand to do a quickie repair on it. We wanted to look at the rotor spars, too, after flexing them once and having the blade flap once. So we tore all the fabric off of them, which meant we had to miss Oshkosh last year, and took a good look at everything, and everything was fine. I had a few kinks in the trailing edge had to be repaired, and a couple of rips in the leading edge plywood. But they worked on them over the winter and got them ready again this spring, and I went out again in April. We started watching the weather, and once it was ready to go, then picked a day that looked like the winds were going to be calm. And Steve, my buddy Steve, and has a Swift, and we flew out in his Swift, and 2-hour flight instead of an 8-hour drive, and did a couple more flights successfully, and we're happy with it. So I ended up putting about 5 hours on it before we flew it up to Oshkosh, and then it was about 8 more flying hours on the trip from New Carlisle up to Oshkosh.
Wow. It sounds like your checkout was complete.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure it's complete yet. It's still, I tell everybody, it's an extraordinarily safe airplane, which was the advertising for it in the 30s. It's very, very hard to hurt yourself in it, but it is pretty easy to hurt the airplane because it has this tendency to these blade flap problems. And it's very crosswind critical because you use ailerons for lateral control. And so at landing speed, which is, 15, 20 miles an hour, the ailerons don't do anything. And so you can't have any drift. You can't have any crosswind. Yeah, that's probably the defining characteristic of flying the Autogyro is that there's no crosswind capability, and Steve and Johnny both emphasize that. And the later Autogyros with the tilt rotors did have a crosswind capability, but the fixed rotor winged early Autogyros rely on the ailerons for the lateral control, and so you can't have any drift when you touch down, which, of course, in a crosswind, without ailerons, be pretty hard to correct for. So you see a lot of pictures in the old books in the old days of autogyros lying on their sides with their blades bent all over the place from having drifted touchdown and tipping over. They're pretty top heavy. And so that's, as I say, is kind of the defining characteristic of it, the thing you really have to be the most careful about. It can fly probably in pretty good winds. I mean, I've seen movies of them flying in pretty good winds, but it does make it trickier to operate. You have to spin up the rotors with a tail into the wind and then turn into the wind and take off. And after you land, you have to immediately turn right. Because the rotors tilt to the left a little bit and try to get the wind on top of the rotors so that they won't flap as they wind down below 65 RPM. So it does get a little more complicated. So we try to keep it under about 6 or 7 miles an hour of winds to fly it in, just to be conservative, because 98% of the time you could fly it in the higher winds, you could fly it in 10 or 15 mile an hour winds and not have a problem. But if that 2% happens and you get a blade flap, in 1934, it was called a factory and send us 4 blades. And a week later, you're flying again. In 2009, it's 2 years of work. So we're very conservative with how much wind we fly it in.
Well, it sounds exciting, Andrew. I mean, it's got to be one of the most exciting things that you've done recently, I would say.
It really is. And I like to think I've had some good opportunities in doing a little movie flying and flying Fokker triplanes and doing some air show work and stuff. And it's funny because the Pitcairn can't really do anything. It's not aerobatic, really, although Johnny did it. But it's not fast, but there's just something about it. It's so unique. And I told people when I first started flying it, it was kind of like you're getting picked up off the ground by some kind of prehistoric pterodactyl or something. A lot of frightening flapping stuff happened over your head. And now that I'm used to it, I kind of feel more like I'm living in a cartoon, like I'm Dick Tracy or something, going in the Autogyro to Chicago to chase after a mobster or something. It really captures the 1930s and that era.
Well, that's neat. Well, hey, Andrew, I appreciate you talking to us about the Pitcairn Autogyro. It's right here at the Vintage Red Barn. It's going to be here all week. You'll be here with it, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's right. And hopefully we're going to fly it if we get the winds calm enough.
Oh, that'd be great. We'll stay on top of that and let our listeners know when you're going to do that. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And that wraps up today's On the Fly segment. If you'd like to join us for tapings of On the Fly, we'll be down at the Vintage Red Barn today at 2 o'clock, taping for tomorrow's show. You can join us right here on EA Radio for AirVenture On the Fly every day at 12 noon. We'll see you at the Vintage Red Barn today at 2 o'clock. For now, have a great adventure here at Oshkosh. I'm Jay Montgi, and you're listening to EA Radio, AM 1210, 93.1 FM, and on the web at airventure.org.